and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for April 22nd, 2011. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, large deposits of frozen carbon dioxide on Mars, cheaper high-performance fuel cell catalysts, and new efforts to clean up the Ganges and other rivers in India. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how much the dodo really weighed, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Billions of years ago, Mars lost the large majority of its atmosphere. While most of what remains is carbon dioxide, there's not enough of the greenhouse gas to keep the red planet warm. The surface temperature is rarely above freezing, and both of Mars's poles are covered with permanent ice caps. But in a paper published online by Science, Roger Phillips and colleagues report massive deposits of frozen carbon dioxide at one of those ice caps, at Mars's south pole. If released, these deposits would almost double the amount of carbon dioxide in the Martian atmosphere. I spoke with Phillips about the implications of the findings from his office at the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado.
We've shown that the current Mars atmosphere, which is composed dominantly of CO2, cycles back and forth between the caps and the atmosphere on a time scale of about 100,000 years. Right now, it's about half and half, and that half that's buried in the pole is about 30 times more than we've seen before in the polar caps. And when this stuff gets released into the atmosphere, it will lead to more intense and more frequent dust storms on the planet and more places on the surface where the water will not boil away.
So in your view, if all this carbon dioxide were released, it's not as if Mars would become some sort of warm or wet planet.
That's absolutely right. This is not a huge amount of CO2 compared to the amount you need to make Mars warmer and wetter. This really speaks to current climate and how the current climate operates.
Your team's analysis was of the composition of Mars' south polar
deposits.
How does that composition there compare with the composition of deposits at Mars' north pole?
The composition at Mars' north pole is dominantly water ice with a bit of dust mixed in. In fact, that's the same composition as the south pole. Both the north and south pole are dominantly water ice with a bit of dust thrown in. There's no perennial CO2 that we know of at the North Pole. There's a bit of perennial CO2, a very small amount of CO2 that we knew of at the South Pole, called the South Pole Residual Cap. That's been known for a while. What we found was an amount at the South Pole that's 30 times more than that found in the residual cap. CO2 is, while a large mass compared to the total atmosphere, is actually a small mass when compared to all of the South Pole deposits.
And how did you and your team conclude that this material was frozen carbon dioxide and not something else?
Well, we estimated what's called the permittivity, which is essentially the capacitance of the material, by looking at how waves pass through the material and found out that it had the permittivity of dry ice, which is quite distinct from the permittivity of water ice.
So this new understanding of the composition of Mars's south polar deposits is based on new data that hadn't been analyzed before or a reinterpretation of old data?
No, it was basically new data from the Sherrod radar sounder that had not been analyzed before. In fact, we worked on the analysis for almost 2 years to basically come to this conclusion. So it was a long, painstaking process of trying to find ways to estimate the permittivity of the deposit, which we finally did, and then came to the conclusion that it was spot on, the permittivity of dry ice and not water ice.
Does this analysis of Mars's southern pole and the composition you report of deposits at the southern pole cast any doubt on previous analysis of the composition of Mars's northern pole deposits?
I don't think that it does. I think that while we still turn out that Mars' north polar deposits are dominated by water ice. It turns out the south pole is a good place to trap CO2. It's more stable there than the north pole, simply by the empirical evidence that that's where the perennial CO2 deposits we already know exist. But they're much smaller.
Something about the orbit of Mars that makes that happen?
Something about the elevation difference and something about how global winds operate in the planet based on how the climate operates. It makes a certain part of the South Pole, not the whole thing, very favorable for keeping CO2 once it's deposited. That's exactly where the South Pole residual cap is, which is, has a small amount of CO2 in it. So the only, until this came along, the only perennial CO2 that we knew where the planet was, basically at the South Pole, a bit off the pole itself, but still in the South Polar cap material.
Does this cycling that happens, as you said, about every 100,000 years or so, explain the atmosphere to the extent that there would be liquid water and that might account for the channels and other evidence of water that we see on Mars' surface today?
Well, certainly, when most of the stuff in the atmosphere, because the atmospheric pressure is higher, there will be more places on the surface where liquid water could persist without boiling. That means there's a better chance for channels to form in the present era of Mars climate.
So past interpretations of something pulling off Mars's atmosphere to a large degree, or because of its dynamo, the magnetic field of Mars essentially going away, is that in any conflict with your team's data and interpretation?
No, I don't think so. I think that what happened on Mars 4 billion years ago was a dense atmosphere, temperatures that may have approached above freezing on many parts of the planet, and the formation of complex river systems. What we're seeing on present Mars is just the residual of that, and what was there before was either lost to space or tied up in carbonate rocks deep in the crust of Mars. This is a residual effect of that, the last vestiges of that more ancient, more dense atmosphere that's now cycling. We now know, as a result of this work, is cycling back and forth between the atmosphere and the caps.
Roger Phillips, thank you very much.
Sure, okay, thank you.
Roger Phillips of the Southwest Research Institute is lead author of a paper on massive carbon dioxide ice deposits sequestered in the South Pole layered deposits of Mars. Find the paper online at scienceexpress.org. Someday, we may all be able to power the machines in our lives with hydrogen, the most abundant substance in the universe. Right now, though, most of us cannot afford it. That's because most of the hydrogen fuel cells developed so far rely on one of the lesser abundant substances in the universe, platinum. The precious metal serves as a catalyst for both of the principal reactions in a fuel cell, the oxygen reduction reaction at the cathode of the fuel cell, and the hydrogen oxidation reaction at the fuel cell's anode. Researchers have been trying to find other more abundant materials to serve as catalyst to cut down on the cost and so increase the availability of fuel cell technology, but there are a lot of obstacles to overcome. Taking those obstacles one by one, researchers have principally focused on the oxygen reduction reaction because of the two reactions, the oxygen reduction reaction needs the larger amount of platinum as catalyst. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, Piotr Zelenai and colleagues report that they have been able to create a family of non-precious metal catalysts to drive the oxygen reduction reaction of a fuel cell with nearly the performance of platinum-based systems at a cost the researchers say is sustainable for high-power fuel cell applications, possibly including automotive power. The approach uses polyaniline, an inexpensive conductive polymer, as a template to build the catalyst. I spoke with Zelenai from his office at Los Alamos National Laboratory.
Polyaniline is indeed an electronically conducting polymer at room temperature. We are not actually taking advantage of polyaniline as an electronic conductor in this work. What we used polyaniline for is to have a well-templated precursor for both carbon and especially nitrogen. And if we are subjecting polyaniline to high-temperature treatment, which then leads to the formation or creation of an active catalyst, which in addition to carbon and nitrogen contains also transition metals. So in this case, because of the high-temperature treatment, we are no longer using polyaniline as a component of the catalyst. It's only a precursor.
Is polyaniline itself expensive to make, even in, as a template?
No, it isn't. I think that for all intents and purposes, what we are looking for at in this case is a catalyst that is at least two orders of magnitude less expensive than platinum. So both materials and processing are relatively inexpensive.
Of the highest performing catalysts then that you and your team developed with this template method and inexpensive materials like iron and cobalt, how does it perform compared to the state-of-the-art precious metal catalysts used in the oxygen reduction reaction in fuel cells?
I think that there are perhaps two ways of looking at it. The first way is strictly scientific, if you like. or kinetic, to state what are the turnover frequencies per active site of the catalyst. And the other way is to assume, and rightfully so, I believe, that the catalyst is indeed rather inexpensive and we can use as much of it as is necessary. If I were to answer your question according to the first criterion, kinetic criterion, I would say that the performance of these catalysts is still significantly lower than that of precious metal-based catalysts, especially platinum. So in other words, the turnover frequency per active site is most likely much below that of precious metal catalysts. The reason I am using most likely is that we do not know yet what the active site is. So therefore, we cannot really determine how many active sites on the surface of non-precious metal oxygen reduction catalysts we really have. And therefore, we cannot calculate the turnover frequency. It is possible that turnover frequency on non-precious metal catalysts is just as high as on platinum, or maybe even higher, but it's very difficult to tell. What we can say, however, is that the amount of the catalyst per weight of the catalyst, including the carbon in it, which is a vast majority of the catalyst itself, is significant. And the electrode layers in actual fuel cells need to be much thicker than the electrode layers utilizing platinum as the active component. However, once we use a high amount of non-precious metal catalyst at the fuel cell cathode, we can come quite close to the activity of platinum-based catalysts at the loadings that are practical for precious metal-based materials. Obviously, in the latter case of precious metal-based cathodes, we could increase the catalyst loading. But again, for the already discussed cost issue, we just cannot seriously consider loading up fuel cell electrodes, especially for high-power devices, because that would make them just far too expensive.
So with the less expensive catalyst that you and your team have developed, you can use a whole lot more of it, and it'll still be much, much less expensive than the platinum-based catalyst.
Yes, that's true. That's certainly true.
And that means that you get more of these oxygen reduction reactions happening, but you're not sure exactly where in the material they're happening.
Yes. We know that these are relatively high surface area, specific surface area materials, and the typical specific surface area of these catalysts is approximately 250 meters squared per gram or 200 meters squared per gram. We know then that we are dealing with a material with high surface area, but we do not know which part of that area is catalytically active. Now, to comment in the interest of fairness, I need to say that there is a limit to the amount of non-precious catalysts we can use. And that doesn't have much to do with the cost, but with the mass transport properties of thicker catalytic layers on one hand, and also conductivity within such layers, both ionic and electronic.
So you can't use an unlimited amount of the catalyst?
No, not right at the moment, without actually developing a completely new three-dimensional structure.
So you may have already found the performance limit of this polyaniline template-created iron and cobalt catalyst, but you can't be sure until you know how the catalyst contributes to the oxygen reduction reaction.
That's very true. So within the limit of the thickness of the catalytic layer, which we can very tentatively set maybe at 100 micrometers, that's the thickest we can go with a fuel cell-type electrode, we come quite close to the performance of a much thinner precious metal catalyst with platinum loading, potentially sustainable for cost reasons. Potentially sustainable, I would say. On the other hand, in order to increase the activity of non-precious metal materials, I believe what we need the most right now is understanding of the active site. Once we have that, we can get the knowledge required to modify those catalysts further and increase their activity.
With this cathode catalyst, what's the next step? How do we get to the fuel cell cars that we've all heard about and been promised?
Time and again, right?
Yes.
So I would say that the next step would be to further develop these catalysts, increase activity somewhat. I don't think we have far to go from the point of view of activity of these catalysts. But we need to look into the durability, long-term durability of these non-precious metal materials in the highly acidic environment of the polymer electrolyte membrane fuel cell. So I think that while in our case we've managed to combine high activity, high durability by non-precious metal catalyst standards and very good selectivity in the sense of making water from oxygen rather than hydrogen peroxide, we still have a way to go in order to get some way to go to get a practical catalytic system. This may also be true of platinum-based catalysts, but certainly is true of non-precious metal catalysts.
And you said the durability is improved and better compared to other non-precious metal catalysts.
Oh, yes.
But it doesn't measure up to the platinum or precious metal-based catalysts?
You see, that depends on the operating conditions. For example, so-called cycling durability of non-precious metal catalysts in the absence of oxygen. There are some protocols devised for precious metal-based catalysts in the absence of oxygen. That durability is very good, in my opinion. But in the presence of oxygen, especially pure oxygen, the durability is not as good as we would like. So I think that if I were to choose the area of improvement where the effort should be, I would say that durability is the greatest challenge right now.
You are the senior author on this paper. Isn't that your prerogative to choose the next area of development?
Yes, assuming I will have funding to continue the work.
Well, understood, understood.
Mm-hmm.
Piotr Zelenai, thank you very much.
Thank you so very much, too.
Piotr Zelenai of Los Alamos National Laboratory is senior author of a paper in this week's Science on high-performance electrocatalysts for oxygen reduction derived from polyaniline, iron, and cobalt.
The Ganges River is extremely polluted.
Science's Richard Stone traveled to Varanasi, India, and reports in this week's issue on a new effort to clean up the Ganges River.
There have been studies showing that fecal coliform bacteria counts far, far above the safe limits that India has set for bathing. So it's very polluted. That has resulted in high levels of waterborne illness, high rates of cholera, dysentery, and other GI illnesses that are directly related to the high bacteria counts. So we know what the problem is. The Ganges is extremely polluted. India has tried for a few decades to try to address this problem, and so they've really been grasping for a new solution. So there is a new initiative now to try to deal with the Ganges pollution. And the government of India is committing $4 billion between now and 2020 to try to address pollution on all major Indian rivers. The Ganges is the number one target. And it's going to be implementing a creative way of dealing with raw sewage. And they're going to be doing a pilot project in the holy city of Varanasi, starting hopefully this spring. We'll get final approval for funding, and then they'll start construction of this project.
Before we get to more about that creative way of cleaning up the Ganges, what's the goal of the cleanup effort? Drinking water quality or what?
Well, it should be clarified that the Ganges isn't polluted for its entire length. Much of the pollution is directly off the cities. So the stretches of the Ganges between the major cities are relatively clean. So the main challenge is trying to reduce point source pollution. And nobody's suggesting that this can be dealt with completely. You can't stop 100% of the point source pollution from actually entering the Ganges. So it's a matter of trying to reduce the pollution to levels which are deemed safe for the ecology and safe for people bathing. I should note that the Ganges is a holy river, and many Hindu believe that it's cleansing to their spirit to bathe in the Ganges. So to create conditions where the act of worshiping the Ganges is not directly hazardous to health, I think that's the main goal, is to try to reduce pollution levels such that the Ganges River water is safe for bathing.
So what are they going to do in Varanasi this time that they didn't do last time?
In Varanasi, they're going to fund a project to create a system of waste treatment ponds And it's based upon a successful treatment system that was first tried in California in the 1960s, the Advanced Integrated Wastewater Pond System, created by a researcher at University of California, Berkeley, William Oswald. And this system has been widely used in the Western U.S., and the idea is to create a very similar system as a pilot scheme for Varanasi. And there's a very interesting person who's been leading the effort to try to build this new water treatment system. The person who's been leading this effort is Veer Bhadra Mishra. And Mishra is a civil engineer who is also the chief priest of a temple. And his family has been the chief priest of the Sankat Mochan Temple for 500 years. So it's a job that has passed down from father to eldest son. And Mishra is the first of his line to have gotten not only a BS degree, he has a PhD. And he became interested in the plight of the Ganges in the 1960s. Mishra began speaking out. So with some colleagues, he formed the Sankat Mochan Foundation. And they began searching for a way to clean the water off Varanasi. They established a research laboratory that would test Ganges water. And that was in 1992. So they've been testing the water quality for nearly 20 years now. And they've chronicled the long, slow decline of this great river becoming more and more polluted. And Mishra and his colleagues were speaking out more and more. Time magazine in 1999 hailed him as a hero of the planet, one of seven for that year.
Will treating all the major sources of pollution under this action plan be enough to make the Ganges River safe for bathers, or will it take a concerted effort of the people who live there or take pilgrimages to the Ganges?
Yeah, well, in this holy city, there are approximately 60,000 pilgrims and people who live there year-round who bathe in the Ganges each day. They wash their clothes there. They brush their teeth using Ganges water. They burn corpses. So you have the ash of corpses being scattered in the water there. You have half-burned corpses, too. So you have a lot of this non-point source pollution. Now, some critics have said, well, these activities, the people who use the Ganges each day, are causing quite a bit of pollution. But in fact, Mishra and his foundation have shown that the non-point sources contribute only about 5% of the total Ganges pollution. The vast majority is the raw sewage that's flowing from the point sources. So it's very clear from Mishra's point of view that if you waylay this pollution, if you can steer it to an adequate treatment facility, then this would really, from his point of view, take care of most of the Ganges pollution problem.
Enough to make it safe for bathers?
Well, that's the open question, whether it will succeed. His argument is if you remove the non-point source pollution, that's 95% of the pollution is gone, and you should see a vast reduction in everything from fecal coliform bacteria to parasites to all the pathogens right now which are causing the high levels of cholera, dysentery, and the other problems. He's saying that much of that will be removed if you build this kind of water treatment plant. So I think at this point, it's been, for Mishra and his colleagues, it's been decades now that they've been arguing for measures that would really make a big difference. And they've been frustrated. They haven't seen this happen. So he's saying, give this a try. And I think with the government putting in serious money now and looking for new approaches, I think that there is a chance now that they could really make a serious dent on Ganges pollution. And hopefully they can achieve their target of having a water quality safe for bathing.
Rich, you traveled to India for this story and live in China. Are the problems and proposed solution unique to the Ganges River or India more broadly? Or might this effort to clean up the Ganges be a model for other polluted rivers around the world?
Yeah, well, I think that the approach that they're taking is one that certainly could be, if it is successful, it could certainly be tried in not just other cities on the Ganges, but in cities throughout India, possibly China, where you do have problems with non-treatment, lack of treatment for point source pollution. So I don't want to advocate that this particular method would work throughout the whole Ganges. And Mishra himself is arguing that, you know, there is no single solution. I mean, this is one of a basket of different kinds of measures which should be taken. But clearly the system that they are embracing is one that has succeeded, has worked well for the past few decades in the Western United States. So there is a precedent. I mean, it clearly has a good track record. And they're saying, let's try it here and see how it goes.
Rich Stone, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Rob.
Science's Richard Stone traveled to Varanasi, India, and reports in this week's issue on a new effort to clean up the Ganges and other rivers in India. Finally today, David Graham, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now, including a story about how much the dodo really weighed. Dave, I didn't know there was such a debate about it.
Well, Rob, if you think of the dodo, or at least when I think of the dodo, I think of this kind of grotesquely blubberous bird, this sort of short, fat bird. If you've seen some of the illustrations of the dodo, which went extinct more than 300 years ago, it's a pretty comically looking bird, at least according to those illustrations. But it turns out that image is probably not correct. And the reason it's probably not true is because if you actually look back at some of the first sketches of the dodo, it actually looks like a fairly svelte bird, maybe something about the weight of a wild turkey, not this giant blubberous thing. But for some reason, these early illustrations were replaced by the illustrations a lot of us are familiar with, this much more blubberous, love that word, bird. And scientists don't really know why that happened, although they have a couple of theories. The first thing is, once people found the dodo and started keeping it in captivity, it was probably a lot better fed than it would have been in the wild, which could have made it heavier, or at least a lot heavier than it is in the wild. And also, there was a trend in the 17th and 18th century in livestock art to make your animals look a lot plumper than they were normally. The idea was to convey this sort of sense that the livestock was doing very well. And that may have crossed over to illustrations of the dodo. But regardless of the reason, in about the 1990s, researchers began to realize that these fat depictions of the dodo weren't correct. And one of the ways they realized that was in the 1990s, the National Museum Scotland in Edinburgh wanted to come up with a new stuffed dodo for its exhibit, and it commissioned its vertebrate biologist to create a replica. And the vertebrate biologist looked at some dodo bones, and he tried to construct a scale model. And based on all the research he did, he found that the dodo only weighed about 10.5 to 17.5 kilograms, which was significantly slimmer than the dodos are depicted in some of these artist illustrations. And that work is not only confirmed by a new study, but it's actually a new study finds that the dodo may have even been slimmer than that. Again, the researchers in this new study returned to the bones. They compiled leg measurements of about 75 dodo leg bones from 14 different museums. And according to their calculations, the dodo probably weighed about 10 kilograms. So really on the low end of the scale that the researcher had concluded in the 1990s.
So the debate settled?
Not quite, because an even newer study, the study I just referred to actually came out about a month ago, but a newer new study that came out this month finds that the dodo may have been heavier. They actually criticized some of the techniques that this other group used. They looked at the bones themselves, and they come up with a weight range of about 9.5 to 18 kilograms, so more in line with what the researcher had found in the 1990s. Now, that's still a relatively slim dodo compared to what we're used to seeing in the illustrations, but there still seems to be this debate going on about how much the dodo really weighed.
And why is it important to have that debate?
Well, it's a great question, Rob. Researchers have these theories about how animals evolve on islands. Mammals that evolve in isolation on islands, large mammals tend to get smaller over time. Birds tend to do the opposite. Large birds actually tend to get bigger and small birds get smaller. And the dodo is a great case study in this because this is a bird that lived on an uninhabited island in the Indian Ocean. So knowing really more about how much this bird weighs really plays into our understanding of how creatures evolve in isolation, especially on islands.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, now into something else whose appearance seems to be changing, but this one isn't an animal. It's a planet, or at least it used to be a planet. I'm referring, of course, to Pluto, which a few years ago, as you know, Rob, was demoted to the status of dwarf planet.
How's it changing?
Well, scientists have witnessed a remarkable expansion in its atmosphere. About 20 years ago, when researchers measured Pluto's atmosphere, they found that it extended about 135 kilometers above the planet's surface. But new measurements suggest that it extends more than 3,000 kilometers above the planet's surface, which would actually stretch it almost a quarter of the way to Charon, which is Pluto's largest moon. So that's a gigantic atmosphere and a gigantic change in the size of an atmosphere over a relatively short period of time.
So the researchers are convinced that both measurements were accurate?
They think so.
So what's causing the expansion?
Well, there's a little bit of a debate about that. When its atmosphere was measured about 20 years ago, Pluto was actually very close to the sun, at least relative to what the position it's usually at in its orbit. And ever since then, it's been moving farther and farther away. And as you know, atmospheres are made of gas, and the scientists speculated, well, as Pluto moves further and further away from the sun, there's going to be less heat. It's going to cause less gas to expand. And if anything, its atmosphere should shrink, not expand. So why is it expanded? Well, one idea is that Pluto may have actually, for some reason, gotten a lot darker in the last 20 years, and darker objects absorb more sunlight, which would cause the atmosphere to expand. Another idea is that the sun actually fluctuates in how much heat and radiation it gives off. And it's possible that researchers are just catching Pluto during a time when the sun is actually heating Pluto up a lot more than it usually does, which could also explain an expansion in the atmosphere.
So a mystery. Any data that researchers want to have that they don't have yet to help make sense of what's really happening here?
Well, actually, Rob, yes. NASA's New Horizons spacecraft was launched in 2006. It's actually on its way to Pluto. It's going to get there in 2015. So we'll be learning a lot more about this dwarf planet than we ever knew before. One of the interesting things about Pluto is, even though we feel like we know the planets in our solar system so well, Pluto was only discovered about 80 years ago, and it takes Pluto 248 of our years for it to orbit the sun. So every time we look at Pluto, we're seeing something that we haven't seen before.
Okay, so last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, for this last story, let's return back to Earth to talk about what is one of the big killers on our planet, malaria, which killed about 800,000 people in 2009 alone. And malaria is spread by a mosquito. And for a long time, scientists have tried a lot of different ways to eradicate malaria, trying to kill mosquitoes with pesticides, trying to distribute bed nets in places like Africa so mosquitoes can't bite people as often. But none of these efforts have proven very effective. And the new push with combating malaria is to genetically engineer mosquitoes that can't get malaria and somehow find a way to replace all of the normal mosquitoes with these genetically engineered mosquitoes, so that you don't have any mosquitoes left that are capable of transmitting the disease.
Well, how do you get those mosquitoes, those genetically modified mosquitoes, to outcompete the ones that are already out there?
That's a great question. That's a really important question, because even if you are to be able to develop this great genetically modified mosquito, the problem is with a lot of these genetically modified animals or even plants is that they often have, because you put extra genes into them, they often have a disadvantage over normal organisms. Something about what you put into them makes them less likely to compete. So even if you've got this great mosquito that you've developed, you unleash it into the population, well, it's really not going to be able to outcompete all those other mosquitoes. So yes, you'll have your genetically modified mosquitoes out there, but you'll have so many of the normal mosquitoes transmitting disease that it won't matter.
Well, before we even get to that, have researchers been able to even genetically modify a mosquito to keep it from transmitting malaria?
They have. In fact, researchers have made mosquitoes that are unable to transmit a virus or a parasite. But again, the trick is, how do you get these mosquitoes to outcompete the normal mosquitoes? And in this new study, researchers focus on something that's called a gene drive mechanism. And essentially, this is a way to modify the genetics of the mosquito so that it does outcompete heat, these other mosquitoes. And what the researchers focused on is something called a selfish gene. And basically, this is a long stretch of DNA that has a way of spreading through populations like wildfire. And what they wanted to find out is if we can hook these selfish genes onto genes that would make the mosquito have a hard time transmitting malaria, something that might mess up the malaria parasite's life cycle, or that would maybe prevent the mosquitoes from finding us in the first place, sniffing us out, as it were, in the first place, anything like that, and try to get these traits to really take hold in the population. And that's just what they were able to do, or at least they were able to do sort of something analogous to this. What they did was they had a bunch of normal mosquitoes, and they put a gene into them that made them fluoresce green. So you have a bunch of glowing green mosquitoes. That was one population. And into this population, they released a small number of mosquitoes that were genetically modified with these selfish genes that actually break up this fluorescent protein in sperm cells. And the idea was, if you've got your quote-unquote natural mosquitoes, which in this case aren't so natural because they glow green, and then you introduce these mosquitoes with this selfish gene that disrupts that green glow, can you completely eliminate the green glow over several generations? And again, here the green glow is sort of a substitute for being able to transmit malaria. And indeed, that's what they found. They found that when they had this big agglomeration of glowing green mosquitoes, and then they just replaced 1% of them with mosquitoes that had this disruptive selfish gene in it, over successive generations, the glow gradually diminished. And by the time the researchers got to 12 generations out, 60% of the mosquitoes weren't glowing. And what that means is that in just a relatively short amount of time, these mosquitoes with the selfish gene were able to very effectively outcompete the quote-unquote normal mosquitoes.
So now it's just a matter of picking the gene to introduce this selfish disruptive gene into?
Exactly. And again, they'd want to target something that would either make mosquitoes stop biting us or somehow disrupt the malaria parasite once it gets into the mosquito.
Any concern about the overall ecology, the food web?
That's a great question. It's something scientists always worry about when they're genetically modifying a natural organism. And that's going to be an ethical issue going forward, because some scientists will argue, hey, we're getting rid of a very devastating disease. But critics are going to come in and say, well, maybe you're just replacing one evil with another if these genetically modified mosquitoes have some other sort of deleterious impact either on us or their environment.
And presumably these ethical conversations will happen before they start genetically modifying these mosquitoes.
Yeah, one hopes so.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about four individuals who fell into a death trap about 2 million years ago and how they're shedding light on human evolution. Also a story about materials that heal themselves. Just shine a bit of UV light on them, and all of a sudden, cracks magically disappear. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about how budget cuts in the U.S. are affecting climate science, and also another climate story about what role the Supreme Court will play in how the U.S. regulates greenhouse gas emissions. And finally, for Science Live, our new series of weekly chats on the hottest topics in science, this week we've got a chat on the Gulf oil spill 1 year later, what we've learned, what we still have yet to learn. And next week, our chat is going to be about the ethics of animal research. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, and join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. Find it all at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the April 22nd, 2011 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.